Good morning. It's great to see all of you, and I'm glad you're here. If you have your Bibles, turn to Mark chapter 5. We're going to see a scary Jesus again, so I just want to warn you. If you weren't here last Sunday, the disciples ended up being far more afraid of Jesus than they had been of a storm that was about to kill them. And we see something similar going on in this passage today. But in the midst of it, I really want you to see the authority and the power of Jesus on full display, and that in spite of all of our history and our bad decisions and our willful decisions that begin to produce sort of compulsive and out of control behavior, in spite of everything that we can do to mess it up, Jesus has the authority and the power to fix it. And that's what we're going to see here in Mark chapter 5. I'm going to go ahead and read the whole story. I want you to have the whole story in mind, and then we'll slowly take our time and break it down. And really, the story is the sermon. It's not like I'm going to read the story and preach a sermon. The story is the sermon, so just be prepared as we go through this Mark chapter 5. I'm going to begin reading in verse 1. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes, and when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country. And people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with the demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. So we ended chapter 4 with this story of Jesus calming the sea. And he spoke to the wind and to the waves. He spoke a word of power to the wind and the waves. And the waves immediately stopped and were still, and the wind stopped blowing. And the way that the disciples responded to that is summarized in a little question. They said, "Who is this man that even the wind and waves obey him?" And the disciples still don't really know the answer to that question. But there's somebody in this story, or some ones in this story, who does know. So watch for that. And we'll begin here in 5 verse 1. "And they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes." So apparently they were in the boat. The storm was stilled. And they sailed on to the other side. And they came to this area of the Gerasenes. Rather than worrying about trying to pinpoint that geographically, the important thing to know is that it's Gentile territory. You're going to see that because they were herding pigs there and various other things. But this is Gentile territory. So Jesus here is effectively beginning his ministry to the Gentiles early in the Gospel of Mark, here in chapter 5. And in verse 2, excuse me. And when he stepped out of the boat, immediately, a man with an unclean spirit drew near to him. So this confrontation between this demon-possessed man and Jesus, it happened immediately. The boat landed, Jesus got out, and immediately this man with an unclean spirit drew near to him. And now they're going to give a little description about this guy. I read out of the ESV, but this translation is mostly my own as I'm preaching it. So because I try to indicate to myself the verb tenses, that's probably too much information. But this one was having his dwelling in the tombs. This is an imperfect verb. And their graveyards were not like ours. How many of you visualized this guy living in a graveyard, you know, with tombstones and stuff? That's how I always visualized it. But it's very anachronistic. They didn't have graveyards. These people, like the Jews, buried people effectively in caves or in holes cut in the rock. And so this guy isn't like sleeping in the graveyard. He's living in an area that's set aside for burial of dead people. And so he's living in the tombs. Like, you couldn't do that in one of our graveyards unless you had a snorkel or something. But this guy, these are caves effectively. So he's living in the tombs. He's making his abode with dead people. And having his dwelling in the tombs. And also, so I don't think it's too much of a stretch that possibly there was some kind of fascination with death that this guy had. You're going to see more evidence as we go through. But also, this would be a good place for solitude. The only time that, I don't think that they put flowers on the graves of their people and spent time like that. They did go and they would prepare the bodies for burials, but then that was it. It wouldn't be a place where there were lots of people. So this guy was withdrawn from society, living in tombs, and experiencing a tremendous amount of solitude. And it's unnatural and it's unhealthy. And those who loved him and even the community around him had tried to restrain him, because the way this guy's acting is so, he's a very tormented soul. And for his own protection, they had tried to restrain him, but it didn't work. And you'll see why in the rest of verse 3. It said, "No one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain." When you see this text, he piles up these negatives. No one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. He was completely out of control. You see the three negatives. No one anymore is no longer. So there had been a time, but no one, no longer, and not even with a chain. So he's completely out of control. And as you can see, sort of reading between the lines of the narrative, he has a terrible condition and it's getting worse. Not even with their strongest restraints could they do anything to bind him. He was completely unrestrainable. He was out of control. Now look in verse 4, and you can see why I say his problem is getting worse. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains. There was a time in the past that they could subdue this guy and protect him and keep him safe from himself and keep others safe from him. We don't know that he was violent toward others, but he was definitely scary. And so they had put this man in chains. But as his condition worsened, it says, but he had pulled apart the chains and shattered the shackles. And so when we read that little description, as his condition got worse, he became even more powerful. This is supernatural strength. If you put me in a chain, I'm just going to sit there. I'm not going to even try anything. I'm not that strong, but if we put Jake or Luke or one of our studs in chains, if they were good chains, they couldn't break them. The strongest guy in our church couldn't break a chain that mattered. And this guy, they're putting him in chains, and he's pulling apart the chains, and then the shackles, that part is even a little bit more impressive to me, that he was shattering the shackles, breaking the shackles in pieces. It's not like he used a chisel and a hammer. I mean, he's, wow. So this guy, see, as his condition worsens, his supernatural strength is actually increasing. Okay. And then it says, no one had the power to bring him under control. That's the analysis of these people. They had tried, they had done everything they could do to simply restrain this man, not heal him, but it just simply restrain him. And at one time they had been able to, but no longer, no one had the power to control him. He's completely out of control. There's nothing anyone could do for him. He was hopeless and he was beyond help. Now, if you're starting to feel a tiny bit of sympathy for this guy, just wait until we go on, because this was just agonizing for me to slowly work through this text and try to empathize with this man. Now, this next verse sounds like hyperbole, but I don't think it is. Listen to how they describe this tormented soul. Look at verse 5. And all throughout the night and day. See, Mark is telling us the frequency and the duration of this guy's activity. All throughout the night and day. Basically, he's telling us it was continuous, totally and completely constant, unrelenting. There was no relief for this man, not ever. All throughout the night and day. Now he's telling, that's the wind, sort of. Now we get this location again. It's reaffirmed. In the tombs and in the mountains. See, these mountains or hills is where there was lots of rock and cliff faces and so on where they could make their tombs. So that's where he was, in the tombs and in the mountains. But what was he doing all night and all day in the tombs and in the mountains? And this again, he was always screaming. Again, we have this imperfect tense, which suggests the idea that he was screaming and screaming and screaming. I, in my whole life, have screamed a few times, and never more than twice together. It's like one scream is plenty, amen? You know? Ah, whatever. And I'm scared, and that's my one scream, and I'm done. Now, I have been present at the delivery of four sons. So I have heard unrelenting screaming, and I know what that's like, but that only lasts for a night and a day if you're Denise Marshall. Some of you three-hour women, she'll punch you if she finds out. So I've heard screaming on, kind of on and on and on, but have you ever in your life heard of anything like this? All day, all night, all week, all month, all year, always screaming. My brain explodes if I try to imagine that kind of torment. And that's what this guy was experiencing. His screaming, the way Mark's describing, is a very vivid story. His screaming just goes on and on and on. And this imperfect tense, and this, because it's the helping verb, was, applies to cutting himself with stones as well. So again, it's the imperfect, and he's cutting and cutting and cutting himself with stones. If the screaming represents a mind-blowing level of torment, this cutting probably represents just an inconceivable amount of self-hatred and self-loathing. There's enough of this man left to be aware of his situation and to hate it and sort of hate himself because of the situation that he's in. Now, there's another way to read it, but it probably indicates, I think, this level of self-hatred that's just incredibly intense. And he was cutting and cutting and cutting himself, inflicting injury on himself. And it's a wonder this guy didn't bleed to death. Now, the difficulty here, and I'm going to start talking a little bit about demonic possession, but the difficulty here is trying to determine the level of volition. Do y'all know that word, volition? Will, sort of self-determination. This passage is very difficult because we have a man with a will and self-determination and volition who's inhabited by a demon. At this point, we say a demon, but we'll know it's more later. Inhabited by a demon that also has a will and also has volition and self-determination. And because the demon is inside the man, when you just look at the man and what he does, you don't know. Is it the man sort of doing this or is it the demon doing this, right? So this passage is very difficult to interpret because of that. So it is conceivable that the demon was the one screaming inside the man and that it was the demon who was sort of forcing the man to cut himself. That's possible. We don't know. But if just my read is that the man was screaming because of this torment and that the man was cutting himself because of self-loathing, but it could all be attributed to the demonic activity as well. Now, like I said, the tricky part is when you observe the man, you're not sure if it's demonic or not, but not always. So, for example, when they bound this guy with chains and fetters, who was actually breaking the chains? Well, see, again, even in our language, we have difficulty saying it, right? Because the demon was providing the supernatural power and so on for that to happen. That was obviously demonic work. But if you and I are just observing it, what do we see? We see a man breaking chains, right? So as you read this passage, I can't answer all your questions about that, not even close, because the text doesn't. But I am trying to make you aware of that dynamic that's going on. The demon and the man, both expressing themselves and their will, both speaking, both doing things, and we're not always sure who it is unless the text tells us. So, I think verse 6. And this one I think is huge. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. So, did the demon see Jesus from afar and run to him and fall down before him? That's possible. But I think it's highly unlikely. I said it's possible. So if you disagree with me and give me a good argument, I'll say, yeah, you're right. It's not anything to fight over at all. But that's not how the story reads to me, and I'll show you why I think this in the next verses. But here's what I think. I think that this was the last conscious effort of a man who had been entirely taken over by demonic power. Little by little, the man had lost more and more control of his own will and his own life to the dominion of these evil spirits. He had a will, but it was almost completely under the control of the demons. And I say almost, because I'm pretty sure with this last teeny-weeny ounce of self-control that this man had, he saw Jesus. And how, see, this is the weak part of this argument. How he knew Jesus, he didn't. How he knew that Jesus could heal him, there's no way he could know except by a flash of inspiration and by the grace of God. There's no way he could know. But that's what I think happened, is that he saw Jesus, saw in Jesus his salvation, and he ran to him and he threw himself at the feet of Jesus. Now, for the next few verses, the will of the man is going to be effectively totally overcome. The man almost disappears from the narrative in terms of the one acting. See, y'all get what I'm struggling with here? The man almost disappears from the story as the actor, because the demons have so inhabited the man, they really have taken him over. Now, what you're going to see here next is, this is, of course, I'll never preach a whole sermon on this, so this is all you're going to probably ever get from me in regard to demonic possession, and I just wouldn't waste your time with studying that in depth. If God leads you to do that, you do it. But I won't do it to you. What you're going to see here in this passage is an example of channeling. You need to know about channeling because it happens today and it happens a lot in the scriptures. So let me describe it for you. And how does it happen in our day? In the occult, like if you go to a proper fortune teller and ask her to call up Uncle Joe, if she's the real deal, then Uncle Joe is going to come, but he's a spirit. And so spirits don't have vocal cords. They can't talk. The only way that Uncle Joe can communicate to you is to come in to the fortune teller or whatever, the occultist, whatever they are, and they use that person's voice to communicate with you. So, I don't know. I don't watch scary movies, but I'm pretty sure there's been a scene where the occultist is operating and then the person comes and then their voice changes and it gets really freaking scary because... See, if they're doing it right, and I say right, evilly, wrongly correct, if they're doing it right, they're actually inhabited by that spirit, and now the spirit is using their body to talk. That's how it works. It's called channeling. They can't communicate to us. They're immaterial. They can't touch things, move things, and all of that. They have to have a human body if they want to be in touch with us. And so that's what this demon, if a demon wants to talk, it needs a human vessel. They can speak their impressions and feelings and ideas, but they cannot speak audibly without a human channel. And that's what we have here. The demons are speaking using this man's voice. We have the exact same thing happen in the Old Testament when the witch at Endor calls up Samuel from the dead and speaks to Saul. If you don't understand channeling, you'll think Samuel started talking to Saul and Saul heard Samuel's voice. No, if he did, he heard it through that's why they call it a medium. Are y'all tracking with me? It's channeling. And that's what's going on in this story. Now, again, in verse 7, we're not 100% sure who's in charge here. In verse 7, it says, and screaming with a loud voice. Now, I'm not surprised that he's screaming with a loud voice, because what did Mark already tell us? That he's always screaming, day and night. And so, I think here, though, that it's probably the demons who are doing the screaming, and the reason is because of where they are and who this man has brought them to. See, look what happens. He said, what do you have to do with me? So now, it is clear from the context that the demon is the one speaking through the man right now. Stay with me, but this is the demon talking. What do you have to do with me? Now, these pronouns are confusing. When it says he, that means the man, and it was the man, but it was only the man's voice. It was the demon who was doing the talking. And this phrase, what do we have to do with each other? It expresses their sort of revulsion and their uncomfort, uncomfortableness at being in the presence of Jesus. What do we have to do with each other? What do you have to do with me? I think they're mad. I think they're scared, and I'm pretty sure they were furious at the man who got away from them enough to bring them into the presence of Jesus. It's obvious that they have no desire to be there. See, that's why I just can't see that the demons are the one who saw from afar and ran and fell at Jesus' feet. Those demons would have stayed where they were. They would have said, you know what, we better stop screaming for a minute. He might find us. You know, they don't want to be anywhere near Jesus. So that's why I think the man drugged these demons to Jesus. And when they got there, they're so mad, they take over and they start having this conversation with Jesus. But look what it says after that. What do you have to do with me? And then they identify Jesus. They sort of name his name and speak his title. And if you do, which I don't encourage, if you do any study at all of the occult, this is how it works. If you know the name, then that gives you a certain level of power and authority over the one that you're dealing with. And so this demon pulls this and uses Jesus' real name and real title. And in fact, what we have here, Jesus, Son of the Most High God, this is the most exalted title given to Jesus so far in the book of Mark. And it comes from the voice of a demon-possessed man who's inspired by what we're going to discover to be a host of demons. Because of the rebellious act of this man, they are in the presence of their worst nightmare and their most formidable enemy. And so they're doing everything they can to try to turn the tables. And look what he says after identifying Jesus, trying to take power over him. You can see, he says then, swear by God, do not torment me. And then he's in that language, it's imperative. He's giving the Son of the Most High God. He's trying to bind him with an oath and then command him not to torment him. And basically, it's a bluff. This is whenever the guy's bigger and stronger than you, and you just walk right up to him nose to nose and punch him in the mouth first. Even though you know he's going to kill you if he lives through that one punch. This is what the demon was trying to do. He was trying to turn the tables and start the confrontation in hopes of getting Jesus to take a step back. But in verse 8, now we start to hear a little bit of the rest of the story. Mark unfolds this thing for us. And the unfolding happens in the tenses. In verse 8 it says, "For he was saying to him," you could even translate it, "had been saying to him." So see, the demon is talking to Jesus, but Jesus has also been talking to the demon. And what had he been saying to the demon? "Look, come out of the man, you unclean spirit." So Jesus is also giving this imperative command. So let me see if I... Okay, he gives this command. And so here Jesus is beginning to subdue and take control of this demon. And the sequence of events now becomes a little more clear. The man saw Jesus and ran to Jesus and fell down before Jesus. And Jesus immediately began to command the demon to come out of him. But immediately also, all happening kind of jumbled up together, the demon is screaming and trying to minimize the conflict. And that didn't work. "What have you to do with me?" But then when he sees, "Oh, this is coming." So then Jesus saying, "Come out, come out." So he says, tries to take power over Jesus by using his name and title and commanding him not to torment him. And so this thing is a lot of moving pieces are happening in this story. And then we get down to verse 9. And Jesus was asking him, "What is your name?" So the demon knew Jesus' name, but I try not to always read too much into the text. I try to let the text speak. Seems Jesus didn't know. And some of you find that impossible to believe, but I don't think Jesus is here asking a question for others. I think Jesus asked the name because he wanted to know the name of the demon. And he tells the demon to identify himself. And Jesus is starting to win this battle. And look, in most cases, it's like, in Revelation, there's this huge battle. All these armies are there. And Jesus rides out of heaven, arrayed for battle. And then he just slays them with the sword of his mouth. And it's all over. You know how it is? So that's how we're used to Jesus dealing with demons. But in this case, we have at least a few seconds. I don't know how long. How long does it take to say everything that we've read that they're saying to? We have at least what appears to be a protracted battle. More than just boom and it's over. So Jesus now is asking for his name. And he replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And now the plight of this man begins to make more sense. He wasn't just possessed by a demon. He was possessed by many demons. And again, the demon is using the voice of the man, and he identifies himself and the rest of the demons as Legion, for we are many. Now, a Roman legion theoretically would have 6,000 troops. Now, they didn't always have a full complement. But when this demon uses the word legion, he's saying we are many. It's not just like half a dozen many, because that doesn't make sense for legion. You know, that'd be like cohort or something, or squad, right? Legion is the name. And the horrible, devastating condition of this man begins to make sense. We don't know exactly how many demons there were, but there were many. And the name suggests an impossibly large number. A shockingly large number of demons. So here, Jesus is really not doing battle with a sick man or even with a demon, but Jesus is taking on an army of demons in this passage. Then in verse 10, effectively this battle is won when the demon identifies themselves to Jesus, and Jesus already commanded them to go. He was saying, come out. The demon knows that now leaving isn't an option. So now he's kind of parlaying. He's trying to make a deal. He's trying to get the best deal out of this that he can. And so in verse 10 it says, and he begged him, Legion, Jesus, earnestly not to send them out of the country. So the pretense of trying to tell Jesus what to do is utterly abandoned. Jesus has commanded them to leave, so they must. But again, using the man's voice, the demon now begs Jesus not to make them leave the country. And again, you're going to know more about demons than you ever wanted, but there's a sense in these spiritual powers that they do have territories. And there's a sort of a characteristic territorial aspect to demonic power, and that they have certain geographical territories in which they are free to exercise their dominion. This is not just New Testament, this is Old Testament as well. You remember Daniel when he was praying, and God said, the angel said, hey, the day you started to pray, I came. But what happened? The prince of Persia was resisting him, and now I will try to help you put this into your New Testament reading, because y'all are reading the Bible through every year, right? That's what Paul is talking about when he's talking about principalities and powers and authorities. So now, I'm giving you clues to help you understand the Bible. As far as I'm concerned, if you try to learn a lot more about this, most of what you learn will be wrong and iffy. So I don't encourage the study of the occult or demonic power or any of that at all. You know what? Everything I know about demons, you know where I learned it? Reading the Bible. So just read the Bible. Watch for this supernatural world, because it is all over it. And so these demons have authority, they have dominion, they have power, but it very likely rooted to a geographical region, and they're asking Jesus not to send them out of the region. And so the main point is that this ferocious, mighty group of demons is now begging Jesus not to eject them from their territory. You see, this victory is decisive. This victory is complete. Well, almost. Look at verse 11. Now, a great herd of pigs was feeding on the hillside. Pigs in Jewish life are the quintessential unclean animal. They were despised as the lowest, grossest animal of them all. And remember, the prodigal did not hit his scummiest, lowest, grossest rock bottom until what? Until he was in the pig pen with the pigs wanting to eat their food. If feeding pigs was bad, can you imagine going into them? So, see, this unclean aspect of pigs, this Jewish aspect of, and thought regarding pigs is playing into this. Even though the Gentile people around them don't know it, the Jews in Mark's audience are totally picking up on this. And verse 12, they begged him, saying, send us to the pigs that we may enter them. And Jesus is like, okay, if you want to utterly humiliate yourself like that by going into a pig, by all means, go. So Jesus sent them into the pigs. It says, verse 13, he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs. And then what happens next is you see a sense of why this man was in such complete torment. Because the unclean spirits came out, entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. Now, I really don't know what happened here, except when the demons entered the pigs, they totally freaked out and committed suicide en masse. And the number of pigs, the 2,000 number, adds further weight to the idea of the legion, suggesting that there were perhaps as many as 2,000 demons in this one man. So here's an object lesson. Satan has supernatural power, and he wants to destroy you. I hope that when you see in your mind's eye these pigs running down the cliff and charging into the water and dying there, I hope that when you see that picture in your mind, you understand Satan's endgame. I hope that when you think of these pigs, see, the man had some kind of rational capability to fight against the base level instinct that this base level motivation that these demons brought into his life, of destruction. But the pigs didn't. Demon came in, oh, let's die. And they died. Satan wants to destroy you. And he has power, unimaginable power. But Jesus has more power. He has the power to save and deliver you. So, after these pigs died, in verse 14, the herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. And so when these herdsmen saw these pigs die and they had viewed this conflict between Jesus and the demoniac, and once the pigs died, they just ran for it. And they told it in the city and in the country. So they didn't just go back to the city, but they spread the news around in the city and in the country. And so the people started coming out to check it out. And look at verse 14. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there clothed and in his right mind. And now here, see, this whole story, so much of it, we saw the man, but the man under demonic influence. And then this central portion of the story is really about the demon and the demons. And now, in verse 15, we're back to the man. But now we get to think about and look at this man as a man, kind of like a whole man, without this demonic influence for the first time. And so we find out what happened to him after they'd been cast out. And I love it. It says he was sitting there. And I don't know how it looked. I don't know if Jesus was standing or sitting. I imagine Jesus was pretty pumped up from this battle. So Jesus, my mind is standing. Who knows? Who cares? But what do we know about the man? He's sitting. See, this guy, I don't know how much time he spent being still from the time these demons got into him. He was constant motion, baby. He was just on the move. He was, because he was so tormented. And now, finally, here's Jesus, and these people come, and here's this totally unrestrainable, freaked out, screaming, scary fellow just sitting on the ground at Jesus' feet. So they saw that. They were like, okay, what's going on? But then they happened to notice, wait a second, Bob's got clothes on, you know. Now that's kind of an eye opener. Oh, so see, This is kind of how a story works. You get a detail late, but it informs what came before. Amen? So now we know not only was he screaming and cutting himself and living in the tombs, he had given up on clothes. And so that made him even more scary. I mean, so now they see him and he's sitting there clothed. And where he got the clothes, we have no idea. Maybe the disciples had an extra change of clothes. Who knows? You know, we don't know. But we know that he was wearing clothes. He was clothed. And then, and this is the beautiful part, in his right mind. I just love that. How many of you have ever experienced temporary insanity? Am I the only one? Thanks, Dan and Neil. Oh my gosh, I hate temporary insanity. How many of you have ever got through doing something and just said, "What was I thinking? It's just so awful." And this guy had been living in that condition of temporary insanity because of the real spiritual, powerful, controlling, dominating influence of evil in these demons. He had not been in his right mind for a long time. And he is now in his right mind. So how did the folks who came out to see what happened respond when they saw the transformation of the man? Because that's what the text gives us, the transformation of the man. Did they rejoice? Did they express gratitude? Did they worship? No. It reminds us of the disciples after the storm. Look what it says there in verse 15. And they were afraid. See, they knew this man. They knew that he was a supernatural freak that no one could control. And now here he is, seated at the feet of Jesus, showing the telltale signs of a new, wholesome, but mind-blowingly powerful ownership in his life. Have you ever driven by a restaurant and go, "Oh, they're under new ownership"? A building. Or you ever walked into the store and said, "Oh, they're under new ownership"? You know, you can tell whenever you get a new good owner. Everything changes. And that's exactly what happened here with this man. They could tell this guy was under new ownership. They knew the only explanation for the transformation in this man's life was the utterly superior supernatural power of Jesus Christ. The nature of Jesus' power was good and liberating. They could see that. Amen? He's seated, clothed in his right mind. But even that could not stop them from being afraid of the sheer magnitude of his power. He had just conquered with a word a whole army of demons. It was too much, and they were afraid. Verse 16, and those who had seen it described to them what happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pig. So they're afraid. So now we get these eyewitnesses, and they're going to come to the rescue, and they're going to, no. Explain. Let us explain this to you so that you really understand what happened. So perhaps they didn't understand, and they had it all explained. They explained what happened to the man and how Jesus cast out the demons with a word of power and how all the pigs freaked out and under the demonic influence and of the legion, and they all killed themselves. And now that they fully understand what had happened, now that they fully understand the power and the authority of Jesus to deliver, now they rejoice. Now they express gratitude. And now they worship, right? Verse 17. And they begged Jesus to depart from their region. Just as the demons begged Jesus to go into the pigs and Jesus let them, so now and tragically beg Jesus to leave. If you beg Jesus for something really stupid, he might just let you have it. The rejection following this glorious deliverance of the demon-possessed man is one of the saddest verses in the whole Bible to me. Their fear of Jesus' omnipotent power makes them reject him altogether. That Jesus has proven that he can give deliverance and life is an objective established fact, and they knew it well. The man seated at Jesus' feet is proof, but it is precisely because he has the power to give deliverance and life. Then the only proper response to this surpassing power and authority is to embrace this fearsome man and take your place at his feet. That's what the guy with the demons did. He knew power, man. He knew power. Even before he met Jesus. But after he met Jesus, he wasn't afraid of superior power. Because he knew what it could do for him. He knew. And not only that, it didn't matter if he was afraid or not. There was only one place for that man to be, and that was at the feet of Jesus. Because he knew who Jesus was. And as fearsome as this Jesus is, he's still a gentleman. He won't make you bow. I wish he would. He won't make you bow. At least not yet. If you beg him to go away, if you beg him to leave you alone, seems like he'll do it. Because that's what he did in this case. In verse 18, this tragic story continues for these people in this region. And as he was getting into the boat, I mean, he's actually doing it. He's actually leaving. The one who had been possessed with the demons begged him that he might be with him. Now, if you've been paying attention to the story, begging Jesus is a pretty good idea if you want something. Right? What did the demons do? They begged not to get sent out of the country. Begged, maybe, to be sent into the swine. Asked to be. Then the people come and they beg Jesus to go away. So Jesus says, okay, I'm going. So if you beg Jesus, you get it, right? No. That's why you got to read the whole Bible. Amen? Keep reading. Don't stop. This guy's begging Jesus that he might be with him. What could be better than that? I mean, this is why I'm glad Jesus is Lord and I'm not. I would have messed this one up. If he begs me to come, I say, done. Come on, get in the boat. Let's go. But that's not what happened. Look at verse 19. And he did not permit him. No. See, he doesn't always do what we beg him to do. Especially when he has a better plan. And he said to him, rest of verse 19, go to your home and to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. See, when Jesus tells him to go home, he uses the word oikos for house. And it literally does mean house, but figuratively it means family. And I always viewed this demon-possessed man in a vacuum. I never realized that he had a mother and a father and brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews. And cousins. Have you ever had a family member just go completely off the rails like this? And Jesus' compassion here blows me away. He says, listen, you need to go home. Go home.